All right, so good evening. We're continuing our study of 2 Samuel, and we are in chapter 14 this evening. Hopefully we'll be getting through chapter 17, but we'll see. So chapter 14 is where we'll be starting. And if you remember, we're starting off sort of on the cusp of a rebellion. And we are talking about a main character, Absalom. Absalom is the third oldest son of King David. Absalom has, in chapter 13, just wreaked vengeance upon his older half-brother, Amnon. And so he has fled for his life. Where we pick up in chapter 14, Absalom is in Geshur, and David is kind of mourning the fact that he's gone. And chapter 14 opens up with this statement. Now, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was inclined towards Absalom. David in this situation is upset that Absalom is gone. He needs to be gone. He's been banished. But he's apparently not happy that that is the case. And so as we are dealing with this section of Scripture, we're talking about the totality of Absalom's rebellion in chapters 14, really 13 through 19, until David comes back into power. So in this situation, he's not upset. And so Joab decides he's gonna fix this problem in chapter 14 with Absalom being gone. And so he brings in a wise woman, which, you know, in some people's opinion, that can be any woman, right? He brings in a wise woman and from Tekoa and gives her a script that she needs to... That was a good comment. Gives him a script, or gives her a script, rather, that she needs to say, a story that she needs to say to King David. Now, what's happening here is Joab is almost taking sort of a page out of Nathan, or out of God's book, as far as telling this story to David and seeing David's reaction to the story. And then, so as this unfolds, Joab, in verse 3, it says, Joab puts the words in her mouth. And Joab gives her the story. And so she goes before the king as though she's mourning, and is able to speak to the king. And she says, "Help me, O king." And the king said to her, "What is your trouble?" And she answered, "Truly, I'm a widow, for my husband is dead." In verse 6, "Your maidservant had two sons, but the two of them struggled together in the field, and there was nobody to separate them. So one struck the other and killed him. So now behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant, and they say, 'Hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother who killed him, and destroy the heir also. Thus they will extinguish my coal which is left, so as to leave my husband neither name nor remnant nor face on the earth." So no descendants. So what is the problem that's presented? What is the problem that's presented to David? Yes, this is a family squabble. So one brother killed the other brother. There is this idea of being able to, you know, kill that brother in retribution for what happened. And so the king replies in verse 8, the king said to the woman, "Go to your house," and basically he begins to tell her to assure her that nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen to her son. Nothing's going to happen to her. And in verse 10, he says, "Whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you anymore." And so, I mean, he's making some strong assurances about the outcome of this event. In verse 11, she says, then she said, "Please let the king remember the Lord your God, so that the avenger of blood will not continue to destroy." Remember, we talked about in other classes the avenger of blood, and how there were actual Levitical cities you could go to escape the avenger of blood. So that would be what, in this case, would be advisable. Anyway, so she's wanting to make sure that nobody tries to kill her son.
Sounds like a big family squabble.
It is, but this is a made-up, fictional thing to get David to react. It does seem that way. And in verse 12, the woman said, "Please let your maidservant speak to the Lord, that the king." And he said, "Speak." And the woman said, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is one who is guilty, and that the king does not bring back his banished one." Now, What are we talking about? How is this anything representative of what David is doing? David has banished his only heir. Remember we talked about Absalom being the third in line to the throne. Okay, there's another one in between that the Bible doesn't even really mention. It mentions him as having been born, but we don't hear about him. And Amnon's already dead. All right, so Absalom had killed him. So here is, in Joab's mind, this is the heir. You've banished the heir to your throne. And so this is not good for Israel. This is not good for anybody in the mind of Joab. And so this is what is taking place. This is Joab's way of trying to get things back. In verse 17, it says, Then let your maidservant said, please let the Lord, word of my Lord, the king, be comforting as for the angel of God. And so she talks about how wise he is. And the king answered in verse 18. Then the king answered and said to the woman, please do not hide anything from me what I'm about to ask you. So basically saying, don't hide. Tell me the truth when I'm going to ask you this question. And so she says, let him ask. And so the king said, is the hand of Joab with you in all of this? So what does that mean? Yeah, so David's standing back. All this is unfolding. She's telling him about you need to bring back the anointed or your son basically, and David's saying, did Joab put you up to this? That's the question, and she says basically yes. Indeed, it was your servant Joab who commanded me. And in verse 20, it says, in order to change the appearance of things, your servant Joab has done this thing. Absalom does get recalled. Verse 21, the king said to Joab, behold, now I will surely do this thing. And Absalom is brought back. Joab falls on his face. Now, remember, who is Joab? Do you remember who Joab is in relationship to why? Who Joab? He's a captain of the army. Now, the captain of an army is an important guy. And he's also David's nephew. So just to kind of put everything in perspective. David's nephew, captain of the army. So he's not just some random guy. He has some authority. He has some power. But he's respectful and is thankful that God listened to Joab. Or I'm sorry, that David listened to Joab in this situation and received Absalom back. So Joab arose in verse 23 and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. Verse 24, however, the king said, let him return to his own house and let him not see my face. And so Absalom turned to his own house and did not see the king's face, which is almost like saying he can come back, but I don't want to see him. I don't want to see him. And essentially, this is almost like a house arrest sort of thing. As we'll see later on. Now, verse 25 and 26 are interesting. What are we reading about in verses 25 and 26? We're reading about Absalom. What description does the Bible give of Absalom? I'm sorry? A good-looking man with long hair, and he could not believe it wasn't butter. Yes, this is Absalom. This is Absalom. So it talks about who he was. He was highly praised, that he was good looking from head to toe, basically, in biblical format. And it says that cut off his hair was heavy, and the weight of his hair was 200 shekels of the king's weight, which is about half a pound when they cut his hair, when they trimmed it. So that's a lot of hair.
Every year,
yeah. So... I don't know about you. I'm not at that level of hair, but anyway. So that gives us this random picture of who Absalom is. Now it might come into play whenever we start talking about this Absalom guy. I just really start not to like him as we read the story more and more. I mean, I can understand avenging your sister. I'll write that one off. But just as the story unfolds, you'll see why. But he just becomes this sneaky guy. Now, in verse 28, Absalom's been in Jerusalem for 2 years. He didn't see the king's face, but he requests an audience with Joab. And Joab says no, or basically doesn't even respond. He sends another response to Joab saying, hey, I want to see you. And Joab doesn't respond. And so what does Absalom do to get the response from Joab in this? He lights his field on fire. He said, hey, he says to his servants, hey, my field is by Joab's field. Go light it on fire and he'll come and talk to me. Is that like best practice, maybe? How to win friends and influence people. Light their field on fire. That's right. So that's what he does. And so what does Joab do? He comes. Just like Absalom said would happen. And he says, he comes here and he basically starts to complain. He says, why have I come from Geshur? It would have been better for me to still be there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. And if there's an iniquity in me, let him put me to death. And so when Joab came to the king and told him, he called him for Absalom. And thus he came to the king, prostrated himself before the king, paid respect, and on his face to the ground. And the king kissed Absalom. It was a pardon. He pardoned Absalom. And so now he could kind of be roam about. And he was no longer on this, you know, house arrest sort of situation. And so he was pardoned. What's interesting here is in that tradition, a kiss was a form of parting, is that everything's okay with us. When was a kiss used in another way? With Jesus and Judas, yes, with betrayal. And so that's why Jesus asked, with a kiss? So a sign that was supposed to be a sign of friendship, a sign of acceptance, Judas used it as a sign to betray Jesus. And so this kind of shows some more of the story there. Now, chapter 15, we have this conspiracy starts to open up more. And so he's there, and it says, and it came about after that Absalom provided for himself a chariot of horses and 50 men as runners before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And when a man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, from what city are you? And he would say, your servant is from the tribes of Israel. And Absalom would say, see, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you in part of the king. And moreover, Absalom would say, that one would appoint a judge in the land, appoint me judge in the land, then every man who is any suit or case would come unto me and I would give them justice. What is he doing? He's sitting at the gate. He has his, you know, his metal chariots. You know, he's got his BMW there at the gate. And he's got his runners that are kind of doing his bidding. And he's sowing doubt. He's sowing discord. He's just getting more and more slimy, isn't he? So here he is at the gate doing this. And he's setting himself up saying, oh, if somebody would appoint me, oh, it'd be different, right? It'd be completely different if I was in charge, if I was running things around here. Which is sort of dangerous to be saying in public as the king's son, right? Quasi-dangerous. I mean, that almost smells of a coup, right? But he's doing that. And it says in verse 6, what happened as Absalom does this? What is he doing in verse 6? He was stealing away their hearts. Here's this pretty boy with his BMW at the gate just wooing them right and left is basically what's happening. And he's winning over the hearts and minds. Hearts and minds, that's the battle here. And so here he is. So verse 7, little cliff notes here are a little... It says, now it came about at the end of 40 years. It should probably be, some of the text read 40. It should be 4. There's a textual variant there. It should be 4. David was only king for how many years? 40 years. Some have said, well, maybe it's in relationship to the end of Saul's reign. And up to this point is 40 years. Because remember, there was that kind of 7-year skirmish in between. So... but there are other texts that read four years instead of 40 here. As we're reading along here, at this point, Absalom comes to David and says, I need to pay my vow. I need to pay my vow. I made a vow to God when I was in Geshur that if I came out, then I would do this thing. And so he says, give me your permission to go down and do my vow that I have vowed. But this is 6 years after the fact, by the way. This is about 6 years. after he's back that he's saying this. And so it's sort of like, really? It's been 6 years, and now you're going to do this? Okay. So he goes in peace. The king says, go to peace. He goes down to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, you will say, Absalom is king in Hebron. And then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem, who were invited, and went innocently, and they did not know anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city in Gilo, and when he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. So here he has 200 people that may or may not know what's going on. They decide to go with him down to Hebron. And he invites the king's counselor to come with him and be a part of this conspiracy, which lends weight and credence to the conspiracy as well. And so he goes off, and then, you know, he's already had his 50 runners that are going out and sowing this sort of discord. I really don't like the guy. I mean, that's just not playing fair. I don't know why he can't just wait, you know, necessarily. So don't like the guy. But what does David do? Verse 13. What does David do when he hears the message? The messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. What does the text tell us that David does? He ran. Here is David, who's fought a little bit. He's a battle-hardened David, and he runs. Why do you think he's running? What does the text tell us? In verse 14 kind of hints at why he's running. Well, look, he says, go in haste, or he will overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. Who is he concerned about? City. The city, the people. If he stays in the city, Absalom, in order for him to be king, he's going to have to come and lay siege to the city. Is that going to be good for anybody? There's going to be a lot of slaughter. This is a civil war situation. And so David, in this case, flees the city before that can take place and leaves. I don't want us to think necessarily that David is afraid of Absalom. Oh, Absalom. I don't think that necessarily is the case. I think David's more afraid of the consequences to the city and to the people in this situation more than being afraid of this son of his. Yes, being more of a protector. And you'll see also as the story unfolds kind of what he's doing as well in relationship to that. And so they all leave. Highlight here in verse 16, but the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. That's going to come around again. And we'll see that in chapter 16. But so they all left, the whole family and everybody left except those. And so as the king's leaving, there's these people who are loyal to him, who are going with him. He has some fighting men that go with him. We have 600 men who are going with him, various people who were with him at Gath, his old fighting buddies. And then we have this Ittai, the Gittite, was from Gath. And David basically tells them, you know, you can go back. You can go back home. You've only been here a couple days. You can go back. There's no need for you to be here. And his reply is rather astounding. He says, but Ittai answered and said to the king, as the Lord lives and as my lord the king lives, surely wherever my lord the king may be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be. He's pledging allegiance to David and goes with David, even though he's not known David personally that long or been in service to him that long. And even though David said, you can go, you don't have to come with me, he still pledges allegiance to David. And we see this guy listed later on. He comes to be an important individual. So here is our introduction to this guy. And so they go, and David says, go and pass over. So Ittai the Gittite passed over with all his men, and all the little ones were with him, and they passed over the brook Kidron. The king also passed over the brook Kidron, and all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness. Now, what is interesting about the Kidron Valley, if you're, I think, approaching Jerusalem from the south. David's city is rather small in comparison to obviously Israel, the Jerusalem today, and even Jerusalem in the time of Jesus. It was very small in comparison to all that. And it was sort of on this hill, and then just north of David's city was the big Temple Mount that was built. And just to the east of David's city is this Kidron Valley. The Kidron Valley was sort of a waste place, and it was not a great place to be necessarily. So passing through the Kidron was, as some have said, is sort of a shameful thing to have to go through the stinky place, you know, where all the trash and that kind of stuff is. And so he goes, when they cross through Kidron, they cross through Kidron, and then in verse 30, what does it say they go up? The Mount of Olives. So here is a situation. In between there, we have the fact that they went. Also at that time, verse 24, Zadok came, and the Levites came out with. So David's leaving, and the priests start bringing out what? The ark. What was important to David? The ark. And they start, well, we're going to bring the ark with. And David says, no, leave it here. Leave it here. God will permit me. If God permits me, I will come back and I'll see it again. Leave it here. And so he leaves the ark there. It needs to stay there. And so he doesn't essentially, he doesn't drag God into this. He's leaving the ark there. And so they go across. They go up to the Mount of Olives. Now what's interesting, there's some interesting parallels here. When Jesus left and went up to the Mount of Olives, you had two kings. You had David here in this chapter, and then in John chapter 18, verse 1, and Matthew 26, 30, talks about Jesus also crossing the Kidron and going up to the Mount of Olives. As they're going up to the Mount of Olives, David is going up. What is taking place? What are they doing as they're walking up the Mount of Olives? They're weeping. They're mourning. Something also that our Lord did on the Mount of Olives. What's also interesting is the Mount of Olives, when you talk about the Garden of Gethsemane. Gethsemane is a place of the press. And so it is essentially an olive garden. Mount of Olives, it is an olive garden. It is a place where they would press olives. And so they're both going up in the same way. And it's really interesting saying that in this context, both were rejected. And both were betrayed, but both returned, right? Both ended up returning in this situation. So it's interesting to see the king, the crossing of the kings of Kidron. You have David, who is sort of a forerunner that promised that Jesus would come through David's lineage, that would sit on the throne of David. And here we have later on the descendant of David doing something very similar in John chapter 18 and Matthew and Luke. All record this event as well, parallel with David. So, an interesting parallel. Now, as I do this in verse 31, now someone told David, verse 31, that Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, "O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness." Now, Ahithophel apparently was this wise counselor that David trusted on, and Absalom in this case also trusted in, and David is saying is praying against the council. And as they're going up the summit to the Mount of Olives, and it even mentions a place where God is worshipped, we have this guy Hushai kind of comes in and meets David, and he's been mourning as well because his coat is torn, his dust on his head. He's mourning this event, and David said, "If you pass over with me, then you'll be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, 'I will be your servant, O king, as I have been to your father's servant in the time past,'" he said, "then you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me." So as David is leaving, he has the priests come out to him, and he tells them, don't go with me. And he even tells the priests that you need to be my spies. You need to be my runners for me. So he has the sons of the high priest be the runners for him, letting him know, informing him about anything. Then he tells Hushai here to thwart the counsel of Ahithophel and let them, you know, kind of do battle in that way. But it tells us here that who is Hushai, verse 37, to David? Is he some random guy? Who is Hushai to David? He's a friend of David. And almost in these next few chapters, as his name is mentioned, Hushai, the friend of David. Hushai, the friend of David, friend of David, friend of David. We see that over and over again, is emphasized that he goes back into the city as things are kind of, as Absalom's coming in and gates start closing down. He goes back into the city. Is it possible that his life could have been in danger? Absalom could have said, you know what? I don't trust you. We're just going to kill you. That could have happened, right? But because he was David's friend, because Hushai was David's friend, he does this thing that David requests of him, and he goes in. Now, they also meet Ziba on the mountain as they're up on top of the summit. Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth. Remember this story? We're kind of coming around again to the guy who was lame because, you know, his nurse fell on him, basically. And so Ziba tells a lie about Mephibosheth, saying that he is conspiring with Absalom. Now, Ziba also brings out some donkeys and brings out a bunch of food and that kind of stuff for the people. You know, here's your travel snacks while you're going into the wilderness. And, oh, by the way, Mephibosheth is conspiring against you. So who are you going to believe? The guy that can't walk or the guy that's bringing you snacks and donkeys for the trip? So David takes this to be truth from this master, the slave of Mephibosheth. And so the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours." And David just, you know, wholly writes off Mephibosheth without hearing that side of the story. And we'll come back around to that again later on. As they're going, has anybody cursed you before? I curse you. Have you driven before? Anyway, so yeah, it happens. But in this situation, it's a little bit different. As they're leaving, and so they come to Bahurim, which is just kind of over the hill from Jerusalem, and they haven't gone very far. Then this guy, Shimei, the son of Gera, comes out and starts cursing them continually. Well, it takes a lot of energy to do that, right? I don't know what rage is pent up in this guy, but he decides to go out. And he says, get out, you man of bloodshed, you worthless fellow, is what this guy is saying to David. And just curses him. And so the picture is given that as they're walking along, this guy is sort of up on a hill, just cursing him. And what do his men say? Abishai, who's one of the commanders, what does he say?
Please let me cut his head off.
Please let me cut his head off, right? I am tired of hearing this guy. Please let me cut his head off. It's basically, if you read between the lines, I think is what... he basically says, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? And he wants... I mean, you can see him just drawing his sword. And David... What does David respond? How does David respond to that? This could be from God. We don't know if not this message, this curse is from God. So just let him be. And even more than that... the insult that he's received from his son is way more than what this guy's saying. So David's already hurt. And this guy isn't really, you know, he's almost numb, I imagine, to this guy screaming. If anything huge, if anything like this has ever happened to you before, and you've been in a situation where you almost don't hear, when you get news, when you get really bad news, and you almost don't hear the world around you, and you're just lost in your head. I imagine myself that's where David is, and this guy screaming up on a hill probably doesn't even matter at that point because he's so hurt from what's going on in the moment, and he says, just let him be. And so the guy just basically followed him and cursed him the whole time, and they arrived very weary to their destination. And so Absalom enters, verse 15. What's interesting, though, verse 36 says that Absalom entered. Verse 15 says Absalom entered. When did Absalom enter? Well, talking about entering into the city, verse 37 says, Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Verse 15 says, then Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, entered in Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with them. So basically what we're saying is these events and these first few events in chapter 16 kind of take place during the process of entering into. So if anybody says, well, you know, here's the Bible is incorrect. You have two different times that they're entering into Jerusalem. It's just giving us more information. So do you have like the same thing happened at the same time, and you're telling, you know, two stories that are parallel.
It would be like a transition period.
Well, it's just two parallel stories happening at the same time is kind of what we're trying to unfold here. And so it wasn't like you just kind of, you know, all the people running into the city takes some time. So that's what's happening. And then, so we have here at the end of chapter 16, Hushai does go and talks to Absalom and says, long live the king. He says exactly what David told him to. What's interesting is that Absalom asks him, he says, Absalom said in verse 17, is your loyalty to your friend? Why do you not go with your friend? So everybody knows that Hushai is David's friend, right? They're BFF. They got the little matching everything. So everybody knows that they're friends. It's not a mystery. And so he asks him about his loyalty. And then what does Hushai say? That is very wise on his part. What does he say? I am for who the Lord is picking, right? I'm on the Lord's side. I am on the Lord's side. Okay, so that's what he's saying, right? In this... But what does Absalom think? Well, of course, that's me, right? That's what Absalom thinks, maybe. Wrongly, but that's what Absalom thinks in the situation. And so he allows him to stay, which is a very good answer on Hushai's part. Very wise guy. And so he stays, and he serves. And then Ahithophel is asked, give your advice. What shall we do, Ahithophel? And Ahithophel says to Absalom, go into your father's concubines. Prove that you have taken over David's house. This is what is done. Now, this was prophesied that was going to happen over in 2 Samuel 12, verse 11, right? Nathan said this was going to happen. And Ahithophel says, this is what you need to do. And so they basically pinch a tent up on a high point, and Absalom does this thing in front of all of Israel, and so they know that he has established authority over David's house, is basically what he's saying in that moment. Verse 23, the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired of the word of God. So was he considered important? They listened to what he said. They listened to what he said. Which is interesting. You know what his name means? Son of foolishness. Son of foolishness. Ahithophel means son of foolishness. So maybe he's trying to, you know, overcome a rotten name. But they listened to him. Both David and Absalom both listened to him, regarded him, his counsel. Now, in chapter 17, we have... The council of Hushai kind of thwarts the council of Absalom. Ahithophel says, hey, you know what, give me 12,000 men, let's chase down your dad, and let's just end this thing. And then Absalom asks Hushai, what is your response? And Hushai says, you know what, this time the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good, he says in verse 7. Moreover, Hushai said, you know your father and his men, and they are mighty men and are fierce, like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is an expert in warfare and will not spend the night with the people. Behold, he has now hidden himself in one of the caves or in another place. And it will be when he falls on them at the first attack, and whoever hears it will say, there has been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. Bad PR, bad PR. You don't want that being said about you, right? So Hushai rightly states the tenacity of David. David's known as a warrior. He's known as a warrior. He's known as being fierce. I don't know if you guys know kind of about a mama bear, but when she's away from her cubs, if you separate her from her cubs, she will tear you apart to get back to her cubs. Just ask Leonardo DiCaprio. And so... So this is a situation where he's talking about the tenacity of David, he's talking about his tactics, and he's also saying it's going to be bad PR. So he hits all the bright buttons, right, in this situation in order to convince Absalom what's going on in this case. And so he tells him, here's what we should do. We need to get everybody together. We need to get everybody from Dan to Beersheba and take everybody out against David. What are you saying? What are you saying? You know, if I was like David, and I was like, I would rather take 12,000 than 40 or 50, 60,000, right? How about you guys on those odds? I'd rather have 12,000. But what he's doing is he's giving David time. He's given David time to get away. He's given David time to set up a fortified place. And he's also giving himself time to tell David what's going to happen. But what he's also doing is if all of Israel goes out against David, I am imagining not everybody is against the house of David. Not everybody is against the house of David. And so you get maybe a situation where not everybody's in agreement. But it creates a situation where David has time to get away. Because if you've tried to organize a birthday party with 12 people, I can't come at that time. Well, we got to come at this time. It's hard. All right, let's get a whole nation to come together at one spot and chase after David. It's going to be difficult. He needs time to coordinate. So he gives David some time. More time than I have, apparently, this evening. So we will have to finish there midway through chapter 17. We almost made it. Thank you for your time this evening.